I thought that today, and I'm glad you did the poll there, because I was trying to think how I wanted to address you people, and I know a lot of you are pretty committed to the cause of impeachment. That's great, especially in this state because of what's going on in the legislature. But I wanted to focus, I think, on those of you who raised your hands the second time. And those of you who are already committed to the idea of impeachment, I want to address this to you also from a different perspective. Because what we really need, if impeachment is going to happen, is a tidal wave of public sentiment for impeachment that will push this cowardly, gutless, and calculating, overly calculating Democratic Congress and unprincipled Republican Congress into impeachment, whether they want it or not. In order to do that, you people in this hall are just a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of the people we need to have in an impeachment movement. And that means that every one of you needs to be able to go out to your neighbors and your co-workers, and you need to make the argument for impeachment. So that's what I want to do. I want to, this president is the most impeachable president in the history of the country. In my book, I called him the Willie Sutton of constitutional violators. You know, as I wrote the book, I had to keep asking the publisher to give me more pages because he kept adding crimes. And he's still been adding crimes since the book came out. So what I wanted to, not all those crimes are going to be impeached. You would not be impeached for, because politically it just won't happen, unfortunately. Even though some of them are the more serious crimes. But I think there are some crimes that he's committed and some abuses of power which are so egregious that any patriot, whatever their party, would have to agree he needs to be impeached for if they knew about it. And the press doesn't talk about it, so you have to. And so I want to focus on those. And I just want you to understand that I'm not going to talk about all the issues. If you want to know all the issues, get the book, which is out there, and I laid it all out with Barbara. But so let me talk about a few that are things that I think you'll be able to tell all your neighbors about. The first one is torture. This president has authorized torture by American forces of people captured in, you know, the various wars, Afghanistan, Iran, the so-called war on terror, and I hate to use that term because it's not a war. It's a marketing term. All of these cases are torture that the president has authorized. There, we know from FBI documents, for example, which we have in the back of our book in the appendix, that FBI agents in Guantanamo refer to an executive order authorizing the torture of Guantanamo. That would be from the president. And the Geneva Convention expressly states that torture is illegal, that anyone in the chain of command, and that includes the guy that loves to use the term, not president, but commander-in-chief, is the top of the chain of command, has an absolute obligation under the law, U.S. law and the Geneva Conventions, to stop it. And not only has the president not stopped it, he's authorized it. He's called for it. And so, you know, right off the top, he's a criminal. He's a war criminal. And his own attorney general, when he was the lawyer in the White House for the president, warned him in a letter, which we also published in the back of the book, that a future prosecutor, because he was authorized to torture, a future prosecutor might choose to prosecute him for war crimes under the Third Geneva Convention. And he warns him that the punishment for that is capital punishment, which would be highly appropriate for this president. But there to oppose torture, purely practical ones. You know, one that I was discussing this with Ray, he mentioned that it, of course, doesn't work. You know, when you torture people, they say what they need, what you want them to say, so that you'll stop torturing them. So you get information that's junk. You also make it so you can't prosecute people when you torture them, so you can't put them in jail. And that's why these guys aren't being brought to trial, a lot of them were tortured, so that they wouldn't be able to be convicted if they were guilty of terror. And finally, and this is the one that I think is the argument to use with your Republican friends and, you know, with super patriot friends, most people in the military oppose torture. And the reason isn't so much the one that you sometimes hear, well, if we torture people, then our guys, when they get caught, will be tortured. That argument kind of falls weakly because some of the people we're fighting are pretty nasty people, and they probably torture our guys anyway. So the fact that we torture doesn't necessarily mean our guys are more likely to be tortured. But there is something that's really bad about torture that relates to protecting our troops. And that is that when your enemy thinks that if he surrenders and you capture him, he's going to be tortured, he's going to be humiliated, he's going to have his religion trashed, he's not as liable to surrender. He's more liable to fight to the death. Thousands and thousands of American lives were saved in World War II because the enemy of the United States believed that this country would treat you, you know, with some level of dignity and fairness if you surrender. And thousands and tens of thousands of Germans and Japanese surrendered because they believed that. Can you imagine what would happen in Iraq or Afghanistan if the Americans put up a big megaphone and announced, we have put down your arms and surrender, you'll be treated fairly and given three square meals and a blanket? You think anybody would surrender and believe that? Not anymore. So I think it's safe to say that many of the guys who died, American guys who died, women who died, or have been brutally maimed, have been maimed or killed because of the torture, specifically. So there's one argument. Let's move on from torture to spying. This president authorized, we now know, and he's admitted it, he authorized years of spying on American citizens by the National Security Agency in complete and utter and deliberate violation of the federal law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was specifically written because another president did exactly the same thing. And Richard Nixon spied on his political enemies, on his own cabinet members, on his own staff. He spied on war resistors. He spied on ordinary, plain Americans, and he used the NSA to do that. And so Congress passed a law saying you can't do that. You have to go to... They were very accommodating. They had set up a secret court of 12 judges who meet in secret, don't keep records, and who give in to almost every request that's ever been made of them for a warrant to spy. I think 4 or 5 times out of the entire 70 or 1,000 or so requests that have been made for warrants were rejected. And I think they were all requests from this administration. But only 4 or 5. And not only that, they were even more accommodating. They said, well, if you have to do it in a hurry because of something like a terror threat, you can go ahead and do it, and you can get the warrant 3 days later. So, you know, it's absolutely no excuse for not getting the warrant. However, this administration decided, I'm not going to get the warrant. I want to do it without a warrant. Why would he have done that? Well, the only reason he could have wanted to do it is he knew that any request he made for these spying efforts was going to be rejected. And what kind of requests would those be? It wasn't for terrorism, because this court has made it clear it grants any request to spy on terrorism. So who else was he spying on? Well, we just have to go back and look at what Nixon did. Political enemies, leakers in his own administration, and protesters, anti-war people, you know, people that on the Democratic side of the aisle. So we're talking about serious, serious crimes by this administration, spying on American people, violating the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. And just to make it clear, this case was brought to a federal court by the ACLU. It was argued before a judge by the ACLU and countered by the Justice Department, and they lost. And the federal judge ruled that the president had broken the law. That's a felony. He broke the law that he carries a 5-year jail term and a $10,000 fine, and she said also that he had violated the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. Bingo. You know, we don't even need a hearing in Congress for that impeachment. All we have to, he's a felon. You know, he broke the law. And so all you have to do in the Judiciary Committee is take the judge's decision and publish it in the record as a argument for an article of impeachment. That one's easy. So the argument you make to your friends is twofold. One is, we've got a president who says that that he can spy on American people without a warrant and break the law, and that means that any president can do that, right? That means the next president can spy on us. So your Republican friends need to think about Hillary Clinton can do this. You know, Barack Obama can do this. You know, that should make them sit up, right? Because one president can do it, the next president can do it. Same argument, right? War on terror, fighting terrorism. So we have to find out what he was doing, and we have to punish him for it. And the other thing is simply breaking the law. The president said, I broke the law. I can do that. You know? Well, do you want to say that that's the standard we're setting for the next president? I can break the law. You know? Just remind them of who that might be. So that's the second argument. And the third one is maybe the worst and the best argument. The worst offense of all his offenses, and that's the signing statements. The signing statements haven't gotten a lot of press, and there have been a lot of misconceptions about it. But the essence of it is that this president claims that because he's the commander-in-chief in time of war, and he's referring to not the Iraq war, not the Afghanistan war, he's referring to the war on terror, the marketing term. And he claims that because of the war on terror, remember that doesn't ever end. War on terror is, we're always going to have terrorism. And so during this interminable war on terror, he claims that he has the right, as commander-in-chief, the title he prefers, to ignore the Congress. He doesn't have the Constitution. He's not bound by the terms of the Constitution. And he has this so-called unitary executive authority, which means that doesn't exist in the Constitution, by the way, that word, those words, to be the executive and the legislature and the judicial branch. He gets to legislate and decide what is legal legislation. So that's why he's done it 1,200 times now. He's invalidated laws of Congress or parts of laws of Congress. And again, I would say to Republicans and conservatives and to apolitical people, do you want the next president to say, I don't have to listen to Congress, I'm the commander-in-chief. There's still going to be terrorism, I'm still fighting a war on terror. Could be Hillary Clinton saying, I don't have to obey Congress. You know, that should really put the fear of God into the Republican right. And I think that should convince anybody. And the best part about this argument is that for people who say, oh, impeachment will take forever, you know, why bother? It's going to be out in 2 years. He has to be impeached on the last day of office, or we're going to have say that every future president doesn't have to obey the laws of Congress anymore. That means that all that stuff you learned in ninth grade civics doesn't count. You wasted a whole year in civics. You know, it's gone. The Constitution's gone. Tripartite government's gone. And we have a dictatorship. That's the definition of a dictatorship. I get to decide. I make the laws, and I get to decide whether the law's real or not. So those are the three arguments. I don't know. Am I used my time? I'm good. Having gone through those three, still haven't convinced them. There's a couple, well, there's one more that I think people on the right and fence sitters should pay attention to. And that's the one that we're watching sort of on the fringes unfolding in courtroom right now in the Libby trial. The outing of Valerie Plame. The real story here is not being told in the media. And I'm sorry, I'm the representative, I guess, of the press here. It's embarrassing to call myself a journalist these days. But what they're missing is they're making the story who leaked or did he leak, you know, which is a pretty uninteresting story unless you happen to be a journalist or you happen to be a Washington insider. But the real story is, why did the government go to such extraordinary lengths to try to trash a sort of a low-level retired ambassador to minor countries in Africa and go to the extreme of breaking a law and disclosing the identity of a CIA operative, an undercover CIA operative, who happened to be responsible for monitoring the proliferation of nuclear weapons in Iran. The very person we need to be really, really on top of things was outed, and that meant that all her sources in Iran, you know, and in other countries where we worry about proliferation became, if they weren't killed or punished, became neutralized and useless. That's why we don't know what the hell's going on in Iran right now, because Valerie Plame was outed. Well, that's bad enough, right? I mean, somebody should go to jail for that. But then you have to still say, why did they go to this great extreme to go after Joe Wilson, the ambassador? Well, the reason is because Joe Wilson went to, he was sent to Niger, this little poor country, I think it's maybe the poorest country in Africa. It's in the middle of nowhere in the desert, and its only claim to fame is that it has uranium mines run by the French. And he went there because there were these documents which the government was, remember the State of the Union address when Bush said the famous 16 words that they later had to recant, that we've learned from British intelligence, don't count these words because I don't know, right? We've learned from British intelligence that Saddam Hussein tried to buy nuclear fuel from a African nation. Okay. Those documents were forgeries. They were rank amateur forgeries because the names on the signature. And by the way, when Saddam Hussein wanted receipts, he was trying to buy 400 tons of uranium ore. I don't think so. And how was he going to transfer it in secret? You know, 400 tons of dirt, where there's no railroads from Niger to Iraq, and there's no ports, you know, and you drop a lot of dust along the way. It's a crazy idea, but then anyway, the forgeries were really cheap and bad because the official who signed these receipts so nicely hadn't been in office for years. So, I mean, a high school kid doing a term paper would have found this out from the CIA country report on Googling that these were forgeries. Well, what they didn't want, the reason they went after Wilson was he was sent there to find out whether there was any legitimacy to this claim that Saddam Hussein tried to buy this fuel. And he found out, of course, that they were forgeries and it never happened. But if reporters had taken up what he found out, they would have started looking at those documents and said, well, where the hell did these come from? And where they came from was a peculiar burglary early in 2001 of the Niger embassy in Rome, right? First, and what was taken from in that burglary? Only two things: letterhead stationery and official stamps. Now, why would you steal letterhead from Niger? No, I mean, steal letterhead from France and you might be able to get yourself into the Cannes Festival. Why don't you just steal stationery from the Niger embassy? Obviously an intelligence job. Well, these documents suddenly appeared on this stolen stationery with these stamps, and they were delivered in October of 2001 by Minister Berlusconi to President Bush. And, of course, we would have known about him because he was trying to get an excuse to invade Iraq. We would have heard about him, except that at that time, his intelligence people told him they were garbage. So we didn't see him waving him around. They disappeared. Then there was a meeting in December by Michael Levine, who, those of you who are old enough like me to remember the Iran-Contra scandal, he was figured mightily in that Baroque enterprise. And then in that meeting also were four guys from the Office of Special Plans, that fake intelligence agency that was set up under Donald Rumsfeld to manufacture evidence for a war, to justify war against Iraq. And the head of Italian defense and the head of Italian intelligence. What a funny meeting, you know? The meeting in Rome. And out of that comes the idea to take these lousy documents and recycle them through British intelligence so they can come back as new documents. And so there's Bush in January of 2003 saying, we have new information from the British that Saddam Hussein tried to buy this war from an African nation. And the lying son of a bitch knew that they were the same documents that he'd been presented back in October of 2001. That is an impeachable offense. And 3,200 guys and women are dead because of that. And 25,000 are gravely wounded because of that lie. So there's the last argument I'm tossing out to you for your friends, and I suggest you use it right. Thank you.